With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Aurelia, a Romanian living in Canterbury, and you're listening to Dan Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, what life skill would be extremely useful but is rarely thought? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
Well, we are talking everything from Aurelia from Canterbury's question, what life skill would be extremely useful but is rarely found? Dane, what... It's a tough one,
but it's a really good question, Aurelia. Thank you so much. That means gold, by the way, Howard. Did you know that?
Nice. Good little tidbit there.
The etymology of AU on the periodic table. Anyway, I digress. Golden question. What life skill would be extremely useful but is rarely found? A photographic memory.
That's a great... You know what? You've won there. That's a very good one. That's a very good one. When you meet someone who's got it, it's kind of almost like a curse, isn't it? But it does sound like quite a useful skill, potentially.
Yeah, I think it's a blessing and a curse. I think it's very, very useful. I think if you are involved in any games of memory, or even games of chance, if you're able to count cards and stuff.
Or just to-do lists.
You know, if you are working in law enforcement and you're a detective, also very helpful. But by, I think by the same token, you know, if you are... As a child, having an authoritarian tell you to do something or talk about something and be able to accurately, almost photographically recall what took place can be very frustrating for adults. So,
yeah, it's a great question. It's a golden question. And thank you very much. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. No question is too big, small, highbrow, lowbrow, or taboo. So therefore, if you like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of our questions being answered by all of our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a British politician. He is Shadow Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, and has been MP for Doncaster North since 2005. He was previously leader of the Labour Party between 2010 and 2015. He served in the cabinet from 2007 to 2010 under Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He also has a very nice podcast entitled Reasons to be Cheerful. And later on this year, he will release a book about the idealistic way we can improve the world country by country called Go Big. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Ed Miliband.
Hello. Very good to be with you.
Thank you for coming on the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. In fact, my book is already, just to get in the shameless plug early, it's already out.
Lovely. It's already out, guys. There you go.
But great to be here.
Yeah. And what did you think of our question from our listener? Life skills that are rarely found but are useful.
So I was thinking about it. Here's the one I would name, which is the ability to have very little sleep and still to be able to function.
That's a father speaking. That's
I need my sleep, but there are some politicians like Mrs. Thatcher, apparently, who only had sort of required 4 or 5 hours sleep a night. And I must say, I'd find that quite difficult. But, you know, if you could create more time in the day, I always think it would be quite a good thing to be able to, and still behave in a sort of reasonably rational way. I think that would be quite a good skill to have.
I've got that skill, just so you know, Dane. I've never told you this, Dane, but I've got that skill. If you gave me like 3 hours sleep, I'll be fine. I can probably do like 3 days like that, and then I'll collapse.
Is that right?
I'll collapse, yeah. I'll absolutely break, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people would then, Howard, as well, because that's pretty good. But 3 hours. So are you able, and this is a question to both of you, not the question, but are you both able to go to sleep as soon as you like lay down? Yeah, I struggle with that. Yeah, it's just the quieting of the brain and trying to relax and stuff. Because obviously you do most of your reflection before you go to sleep. So I feel like my brain is almost more active sometimes than when during the day than when I'm before I go to sleep. So I find it very hard. Whereas the Margaret Thatcher thing doesn't really surprise me.
The thing that I find difficult is sort of it's when you wake up in the middle of the night, you go to sleep for a few hours and then something wakes you up and then you're sort of, that's the thing that sort of slightly gets me. But the ability to switch off, I think maybe working, my wife Justine always says to me, you know, the later you work into the evening, the harder it is to switch off.
That's why comedians can't sleep.
My hours are way off. I know there's so many like people that advertise very organized and efficient routines about wake up at 5. Like, you know, Mark Wahlberg had that workout when he was like, wake up at 4, go for a jog, exercise, then have a protein meal. And he's like done 2 days of gym working by 7 a.m. Whereas I go to bed, I think I'm in bed only for a couple hours when Mark Wahlberg was waking up, because comedians are night owls. I'm a nocturnal species. So
yeah.
We kind of do like shift work. I lay down and take care of Dreamland as a superhero, and Mark Wahlberg wakes up.
Yeah. But you are intertwined in some kind of
eternal species.
It is probably time for a question, Dane, as the format of this show dictates, mate.
Absolutely, Mr. Ed Miliband. As our very esteemed guest, we'd like to welcome you to the platform to ask the first question, which we'd like to discuss with you for 15 minutes or so. Then Howard will do the same. We'd like to ask a question towards yourself, which we'd like to discuss for 15 minutes, and then lather, rinse, repeat. I'd like to direct a final question towards yourself. And then we would like for you to tell our listeners, if they don't know where they can already, find out more about your good works. And more about the good work you're doing. How does that sound?
Sounds great. Shall I go?
Absolutely.
So my question to both of you is, what gives you hope?
Oh, interesting. Ooh. Can I ask what inspired this question, please, Ed?
Well, look, it's partly what my book is trying to do, because I, as you will probably know, I was leader of the Labour Party, Dane said in his introduction, in 2015, and then I lost the general election and resigned. And I felt pretty hopeless at that point. And I then started this podcast with Jeff Lloyd, radio presenter, which was trying to look at ideas from around the world, because the whole idea of the podcast, the idea of the book, is there are great ideas around the world to solve any problem we have in this country if we only sort of lift our eyes and look out for them. So whether it's affordable housing, climate change, the inequality we face, how we tackle sort of the wealth gaps that we have as a country, how we have better care for young people, older people, how we improve our democracy, all of those things are solvable problems. And so I suppose what gives me hope is partly thinking there are great ideas out there to solve the problems, to answer those problems. It's not like these problems are insoluble. And secondly, which also the book does, is the people who are making change happen, both in this country and elsewhere. So when I lost the general election, I
just want to let our listeners know that you laugh as you say that, just because everyone would be able to laugh about that.
It's sort of, maybe it's a bit of a forced laugh. So when I lost the general election, I went on this course that autumn. It's called community organizing, which is basically how do you organize at the grassroots, and it's a whole method, right? And the story that sticks with me, and you have to bear with me here a bit, and I interviewed them for my podcast recently. There were some Somali young people in Cardiff, right? Who felt really sort of alienated by a whole set of things. And the thing they most, but this organization, Citizens UK, got in touch with them, met them and said, well, what do you really want to change? And they said, well, a thing that is possible to change. And they said, there are three Nandos in Cardiff and none of them are halal. And they said, we want one of them to become halal, right? And so they did this campaign, including with the Nando's suits, including threatening for the Bishop of Cardiff to dress up in a chicken suit. And they got their halal Nando's. And now they are like community campaigners campaigning for the living wage and other things. Now, why do I tell that story? Because I think people's ability to change things is something we underestimate. Actually, good people getting together can change things. So that's what gives me hope.
And Dane, you've said that many times about, you know, activism. We talk about activism on this show quite a lot, Ed. I mean, I don't know what your answer is, Dane. I definitely know what mine is, mate. That's
an example of a lot of great hope, is that, you know, it's despite sometimes the overt narrative you hear from mainstream media is this idea that there are schisms all over the country. But to see, you know, guys, young men who were Somalian immigrants who very clearly are happy to integrate within to British society just based on one small stipulation, which I guess a halal Nando's would be the equivalent of having a pub. And so that gives me a lot of hope, as does, I'd say, I attended the Black Lives Matter protests last year, and I was one of the oldest people there. And that gave me a lot of hope that there is a whole successive generation of politically active and politically astute young people who are aware of, issues of race relations in this country, are working to address and try to alleviate those racial tensions. And for me, it's very refreshing to feel like, you know, I don't have to necessarily worry about if young people are as politically engaged as previous generations have been, because they are completely as, if not more so.
That was literally going to be my...
I thought he was going to do football.
No, I didn't do football. I'm an Arsenal fan. I was literally going to say the same thing, which is young people. There's something, and this is a complicated one in many respects, because there are things that I think are distracting young people from some issues that maybe... should be more focused on. I think you can be easily distracted in this era, but the way the young people are now compared to what they were like when me and Dane were there, like, I don't think we engaged at all, right, Dane? I personally, it didn't feel that way. Because life under Blair, if we kind of compare that era, like, you know, it was quite promising.
When economic prosperity does give people the privilege of not really having to scrutinize politics as much as they have to do now. In some way, you know, and that was a slogan that things could only get better. But I think, I definitely had a lot of optimism around that time. I think, you know, the availability of higher education and stuff, more affordable housing at the time created a whole zeitgeist of hope at the time. I'd say, obviously, economic times have changed. But I would say that's another thing that gives me hope, is watching how people have learned to thrive and to endure tougher economic times. And if nothing else, it's just made people pay a lot more attention to how their country and how their bipartisan political system works.
But also kind of some freedoms, right, Dane? So, you know, kind of take, for example, you know, LGBT issues that, you know, when we were growing up were far more... kind of, I don't know, it was just a diminished, we just didn't offer the same.
Very superficial at best. Is
there you go.
You would see, it would be like having a very, maybe a palatable aesthetic for more marginalised groups would appear maybe in TV, mainstream media, and it'd be quite kitsch or caricatured, and that would be fine. But I think that the democratisation of social media and seeing a new landscape for democratic voices to kind of play out is very difficult, obviously, because you get a lot of negative narratives on social media. But at the same time, it has provided an enormous landscape for a global method of communication for younger people and for people in general. It provides opportunities and access to information that may not be so privy to people if they just subsisted on mainstream media.
Well, it's like an evolution, isn't it? It's like an evolution of thought that these young people are kind of growing up with, so that kind of some things that we were growing up with are... kind of, like I say, diminished. I don't know if you kind of feel that. You mentioned your family or young people, Ed. You know, I don't know if you feel that you're seeing the same thing that me and Dane are seeing.
Definitely. And I'm really struck by what you say about LGBT rights. Because, look, when I was growing up, it was the time of Section 28, which was supposedly outlawing teaching, in inverted commas, of homosexuality in schools. I mean, it was a terrible time. And, you know... the transformation has been extraordinary, and that isn't to say there aren't still battles to be won, but here's the thing, which I also say in the book, and which I do strongly feel it's a strange thing for a politician to say, it didn't happen because politicians made it happen. I mean, politicians did do the legal changes, but actually it was lesbian and gay people who said, we're not putting up with this. And it's this thing of struggle, and, you know... that's what political change is. It is about struggle, and it is about hard struggle, and it is about defeat as well as victory. I mean, maybe I'm a good person to say that. I think that is sort of, I think that's really, really important that it is, it's really hard. You know, It isn't easy, and it is sometimes sort of the progress is glacial, and that you sometimes think, is it really making a difference? And then yet things move. And if you can get enough people together for a movement, you can get change. And by the way, the other thing that gives me hope is being a public figure is a slightly peculiar existence, because, you know, people recognize you on the street and so on. And maybe it happens a bit less than it did, but it still happens. People are basically very nice. I know that sounds ridiculous, maybe, but I mean, people are basically decent. Yeah. You know, you get an image of the country sometimes from the newspapers and elsewhere, which is, and from Twitter, social media. Actually, most people are basically decent.
Mm.
And I think that is, and I sort of feel that, you know, I kind of, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of very decent, you know, good-hearted people out there. And I'd say that's most of the country.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well to think of public figures. That's another thing that kind of gives me a bit of hope. You know, people like Marcus Rashford, you know, other footballers who maybe aren't getting as much kind of headlines, but are still kind of doing a lot of great charity work, make a huge difference.
Totally. I mean, look, what Marcus Rashford has done on free school meals, on all of those issues, has been extraordinary. And, you know, I think is incredibly impressive. And the England players and, you know, standing up against racism, all of that, I think is, you know, and, you know, we can't do this podcast at this time without mentioning Gareth Southgate. I mean, you know, what a model of leadership and sort of decency he's showing, I think.
Yeah, and he's really contextualizing his efforts as an England manager along lines that would be idealistic for everyone, because it's like, there is no preference based on name or status amongst players. There's definitely no preference based on, you know, ethnic origin or racial background. So Gareth Southgate almost, maybe unwittingly, strategically has provided a successful and efficient cosmopolitan England team.
Totally. Which
on holographic principle could show people, like, you know, this is, us arriving to the final has been a culmination of a collaborative effort of people who are from various backgrounds but identify as English. And if we create a society whereby we are equally inclusive and we do celebrate, you know, the same attributes of various parts of society, or segments of society, meritocratically, we could have an England team, so to speak, or metaphorically, about the population of English people that could also, you know, elevate the status of the country.
This is who we are, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think the other thing I'd say, by the way, about Southgate is it's not a chest-beating model of leadership.
No.
You know, it's a sort of very empathetic model of leadership. It's trying, you know, as I understand it from reading about him and so on and listening to him, it's about understanding his players. It's about who they are, what their life experiences have been. You know, there's quite a lot politicians could learn from.
Yeah, humanizing all sides. You know, politicians normally, I guess, and you have more experience than me, of course, a lot of the time they have to kind of orientate their narrative or their about joining a group by pitting that group against another group. So a lot of time it can be, you know, well, being a Labour MP means I have to mobilize Labour constituencies to oppose Conservative views or those who vote Tory, when in reality there is always going to be some intersectionality of outlook for all people. As you said, everyone's, for the most part, is relatively moderate and relatively decent, and only extreme instances of fear do people tend to, you know, act outside of that level of basic human decency.
Well said.
It's such a weird thing. I believe that football culturally might be, and that's why it, as a effectively used as a tool, can be one of the greatest bases or examples set for cohesion and unity amongst, you know, British people.
Definitely.
Because, you know, I've heard stories, like friends have told, people have said that, like, even kids that have left the UK to go and join terrorist camps years ago would still call home and decide they could be tracked by Interpol or MI6, is that they would call home and be like, what's the football school's the match of the day? Because they still have an affinity with it. Like, so, you know, that definitely gives me hope. I'm not blind as I think, like, you know, I just couldn't identify completely jingoistically with the idea of football and stuff. But I think, you know, as Gary Neville said during the match, Gareth Southgate's a good leader in that, you know, he is serving as a conduit between these players and whatever angst and whatever complexes they may have, and, you know, between other stakeholders within the game. And he's protecting these players while being accountable to these stakeholders, but also taking into account their humanity, not just, you know, their athleticism. And we're seeing positive results. So I think, yeah. With the correct counsel, the youth of the gives me the most hope for the future.
Definitely. And what a brilliant question. In fact, just discussing that for 15 minutes gives me some extra hope as well, actually. So thank you, Ed, for bringing that to the show.
Pleasure.
My question is going to kind of spike us towards a little bit more of political discussion that's maybe slightly different, which is kind of, you know, the Labour Party you led was off the back of Gordon Brown, if that's correct. Unless I'm wrong.
My previous
Yeah. And my question is, you know, kind of after Corbyn and now Keir Starmer, how left can the left go? Because I feel like the right has definitely gone pretty right over the last few years. So how left can the left go? Because it feels like we're in an era where the right is saying that the left is going so left, you should be terrified of what they're doing. That's potentially nonsense, as some of us know. So I'm fascinated to know what you think of how left the left can go in the UK for now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, that is such an interesting question, Howard. I suppose my starting point, and this isn't going to, it won't end up as a politician's answer. I'll try and answer it as candidly as I can. I think my starting point is not the label. It's the, what is the situation of the country? This is the way I've thought about the book. So we've been through the financial crisis, Brexit, and all of the division that caused. And now we've had coronavirus. And what that has shown up about our society and the way it's run, you know, how much of our our key workers, our care workers, our most important workers in our country, arguably the least paid, the least secure, our public services underfunded, whether you're able to work from home, not work from home, whether you're able to be safe at work, power, issues of power at work, you know, all of those things have been thrown into sharp relief. And so when I look at those three crises in a decade, I think to myself, the country needs big change because. And that's even before you get to the climate crisis. And, you know, this is something that I've obviously deal with in my day job, and I was the climate secretary a decade ago. We're in the decisive decade on climate. You know, unlike any other issue, how we deal with climate this decade will have implications not just for like now, but for generations to come.
Oh, right? Ed, we've talked about it many times in this podcast. Yeah, where we say, no matter what you're talking about, if there's no planet to live on, these things aren't going to matter.
Exactly. So then you look at all of those things and you think, how can you not say we need big change? You know, You've got to have big change. You've got to answer these fundamental problems. I think it goes actually back to what Dane was saying earlier on about young people and their response to the situation they find themselves in. So that's sort of my starting point. And then there's this elusive thing in politics, which is the center ground. Politics is one in the center ground, you know, where the middle voter is. Well, that's sort of true. But the question is, where is the center ground?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, is the center ground, you know, like we have expensive higher education, we pay our key workers badly, we don't fund our public service. Well, I don't think that's where the center ground is. I actually think, you know, the center ground is somewhere else. The center ground is where we do need decently funded public services. We do need our key workers to be paid. I don't think that's particularly left wing, you know.
That's such a good point that, you know, referring to like where we orientate people from the center or being centrist. I mean, for me, just based on what you're saying, maybe it stands to reason that maybe there are certain elements of municipal or civil services which could make part of the centrist base anyway. So, based on what you're saying, you know, most people in most parts of the country are somewhat moderate. Surely there must be a list or enough moderate policies or centrist policies that we could all adopt and agree upon, and then people can kind of move around there. Does that make sense?
In terms
of like you said. So it's like everyone should have clean water, for example. Everyone should have access to electricity, or, you know.
Yeah, or should Amazon, you know, should Amazon and companies like pay their taxes?
Yeah, everyone should agree on that. Yeah,
everybody should think, well, definitely the tech companies should pay the, you know, proper taxes. Yeah. You know, as I say, should our key workers be paid, you know, properly?
At least a sustainable wage. Yeah, you know, sustainability doesn't just apply to the climate. It's like, because even I am like, even if you are someone with conservative leanings, you understand that you have an interdependent relationship with other aspects of society, whether it's business, you know, free market, or even, you know, civil services. So surely you'd want that to perform at its most optimal level. Even if I was a Tory, surely I'd want someone who's driving me somewhere, as you know, someone who's really mentioned someone driving somewhere, someone who's building the roads which I drive on, you'd want that person to be of optimal health and, you know, intelligence to perform that job to the best of their abilities. So would you not provide a framework which supports that?
Completely. Right. Now, that's in a way the optimistic thing. I just want to sort of put a note of not exactly pessimism, but just the thought about political change, which is that when new ideas are first proposed, they are often derided. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to present myself as the great, like, you know, person here, but so when I said we should put a cap on energy prices, right, when I was Labour leader, I was like, well, the energy prices are like a bit of a rip-off. Like, people are getting, you know, the companies are getting away with it. David Cameron famously said, you're living in a Marxist universe, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was like, you know, that's the nonsense idea. It's never going to work. Now it's the government policy, right? Yeah. And some of the other things I said also then became government policy. Now, so partly I sort of say this because, you know, there's this American writer who once said this thing that I remember, which is, and this is obviously her perspective as a leftist. She says, the good ideas start out on the left and they end up in the centre. Yeah. And in a way, and that's her perspective as a leftist. But the point is, and some people on the right would say that about themselves, but I think there's something in this, which is good ideas start off as controversial. First they ignore you, then they deride you.
Well, a great example of that has been when we've talked before about Andrew Yang, who was running for the president, and he talks about universal basic income.
Livable wage,
Universal basic income was the most crazy thing that give everyone, it was like $1,000 a month, whatever it was, and that will make the economy work. And then we've gone through a pandemic. Basically, that's happened, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah, complete
stimulus package, or Colin Kaepernick kneeling as a protest to police brutality was vehemently opposed throughout both nations, and now is become a part of the natural etiquette before football games kick off. So,
you're completely right about this. You're completely right about this. But let me just say to you, it is hard. It is because making the case for things. I've got this quote. There's this famous political philosopher, Niccolo Machiavelli. Sorry to do this to you.
Yeah.
He wrote hundreds of years ago. He said, there's nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. For the reformer has enemies in all those who profit by the old order, and only lukewarm defenders in all those who profit by the new. And maybe Colin Kaepernick is a good example of that. You know, it's hard, this, because people are sort of quite resistant to the change. They sort of think, you know, well, it tends to be dismissed. One other thing, which is, sorry to kind of sound like a nerd here, but well, actually I am. So there's this concept in political science called, and I think this is really important, it's called the Overton window. That's the window in which political debate takes place. I think what's so interesting about your Andrew Yang point is he shifted the Overton window. So suddenly an idea that looked like on the margins became kind of debated as a kind of serious idea. And so one of the things that politics does is, as well as sort of changing things straight away, it shifts that Overton window about what's, you know, acceptable, what's within the bounds. And that's a really important thing.
And it works both ways, because obviously a man like Donald Trump, who says anything that comes into his head, does the damaging side of that. But the positive side of shifting that Overton window, which hopefully listeners, you enjoyed that, a bit of information, is that it can happen. But I think one of the things that I always think about, and Dane, we've done 100 plus episodes of this show together, and it's like I say things a bit regularly, but that's because they're still not changing, is, you know, what are the principles people live their lives by? You know, what are the principles you live life by? And that's not a universal thing. That's not a universal thing. You know, there's religion. Religion can offer some guidance. Some people take that very, very seriously. Some people don't. Some people don't believe it at all. And using, you know, our lives and our brains and our, you know, relationships, like me and Dane, you know, we've used our relationship to talk to great people, you know, for this show, which hopefully helps people get a kind of idea of how they want to live their life. But there's no, it's not like you're born and you get the rules. And those rules, I think, they could actually be established a little bit more, not like you have to do this, but it's like, for example, we don't want to end the planet. There's a rule that we can all... We don't want to end this planet, because then about 20,000 people will get on a spaceship and that will be a plot to a movie that nobody really wants to see. It would be quite entertaining, but we prefer the planet to keep going, right?
But do we though, or do some of us want the planet to remain and some of us are prepared to make an omelet by breaking a few eggs in order for us to arrive at Mars and take advantage of their very ferrous, iron ore filled planet. So that's really.
That's money, right? That's just basically money. That's the capitalist kind of.
It's the true prevalent faith system. And, you know, if you were not to look at industrialists as businessmen or, you know, leaders of commerce, and instead looked at them as religious zealots, maybe they wouldn't have as much credibility then.
But that's that whole pessimism optimism thing, which you're completely justified in what you've just said. It's just that sense of like, okay, so rule number one, don't ruin the planet. Well, what if it's being convenient? Well, if it's being convenient, you know what? You probably actually do just need to not. I mean, what's the worst that can happen if we don't destroy the planet? You know, people say climate change is a conspiracy, Ed. I'm sure you've heard people talk about this. It's like, what's the worst that can happen if you don't ruin it? You know.
completely. Well, it goes back to this thing, doesn't it? Which is, I think a number of different competing things are true here, which is, I think Dane's completely right about the fact that there is, you know, a center ground where you can, like, do some really important things. And actually, there's going to be a consensus, I think, for a lot of those things. But I think the climate thing does sit on its own, because we're in a race against time. And there are big interests, big fossil fuel interests, that it's not like the individual people who run these companies are, like, quote-unquote bad people. It's just that, like, the economic system that they work under, I'm not saying they don't have responsibility, they do, but the economic system they work under demands that they carry on extracting the fossil fuels from the ground.
This is a complicated question.
how can we change that? But again, I think there is sort of cause for optimism. There's this movement I talk about in the book, which is the so-called divestment movement. So that's like stopping people investing in fossil fuels. And it began as a tiny thing in American universities, and it's now like a multi-trillion dollar campaign that's like got the Church of England and all kinds of other people involved. So, you know, it's hard. Change is hard, but it is winnable. And I think it's winnable, and I think you can you can shift things. You can the center ground can really can it, the center ground is actually, I think, more progressive than a lot of people say, and it can also shift.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant, and thank you for taking on that question. That's you know, slightly, or it's a bit spicy potentially, given the last 10 years of the Labour Party, which has gone up and down. But I'm going to hand it over to Dane now for the final question of today's show.
Thank you, Howard, and thank you, Ed. I'm not, with regards to the status of the left, I'm not sure if I am as optimistic as Howard is in terms of crests and troughs. I have lamented watching what I believe is a much slower erosion of kind of left of centre quasi-socialist values in this country. Even to people who historically would have held some kind of socialist views have partially due to disillusionment, and I think also partially just due to, you know, being in a privileged position where they probably have, you know, can take advantage of certain elements of commerce that they wouldn't have been able to do previously. And that can be very difficult to give up. So I guess my question is, from your standpoint, what would you said would have been the height of socialism in this country? Because I feel like if we don't return to some state of egalitarianism and care for other human beings, then we could see the complete erosion of the left in this country. So are there like halcyon days of socialism that you recall?
High points, I guess.
A highlight reel where we could focus and maybe return to whatever political structure or manifesto kind of preceded those. Because
things we could celebrate on Instagram.
Because for me, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, For my recorded memory, one of the greatest achievements of the people of this country was after witnessing, you know, unbelievable amounts of sorrow and genocide at hands of the Great War, made it a point of principle to say that there should be a framework within this country where if anyone needs any medical attention, they should receive it. And now we are on the cusp of potentially losing that, which I think would be one of the greatest modern-day atrocities of this country, if nowhere else. So
it's great, Dan. It's a great question. I was actually going to start there. I was going to start with the NHS. Because, look, the NHS, I mean, it is such an interesting history, this. So, you know, your listeners may not be aware of this, but up to 1948, we didn't have a comprehensive free-at-the-point-of-use health service. Mm-hmm. You had to pay. It was a patchwork charity, private. It was a mess, and people had to pay for healthcare. You know, like we look at America now and we think, oh, we wouldn't want that. Well, that's something like what we had. And, you know, what are the roots of this? I mentioned in the book that in 1909, there was a report on what's called the poor law, helping poor people in our country. And there was a minority report, like just a few people in the report, they're not the majority. They said, well, we should have something like a national health service. So that was 1909. It took till 1948. But top of my highlight reel is the NHS. Mm. And think about, you know, then fast forward to where we are today, Dave. And what is our, I genuinely say this, what is our proudest institution? When you ask the British people, they say it's the national health service. And think about its principles. You know, you don't have to leave your credit card at the, you know, at the door of the A&E. You know, you're treated free at the point of use, whoever you are, rich or poor. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who work in the NHS, I mean, it is an extraordinary, its performance in the vaccine rollout in Britain, you know, it's extraordinary. And I think it is, I do think it is such an important principle. I think it is a sort of socialism at the heart of our country.
Yeah.
And I worry about it. I worry about the waiting lists. I worry about the waiting times. I worry about the privatization. But I don't think it's going to... I think it's fundamentally untouchable in its core principles. Mm-hmm. Because I think it is... It's so, they can do privatization by stealth, which is the waiting lists are so long you've got to pay to get treated quickly. But you can't... the British people's attachment to it is so great. So that's my number one on the highlight reel. I think... even though it's the decline in democracy and all that, the struggle for the vote, you know, that didn't happen because like rich people wanted like everyone to have the vote. It's because, you know, people, including women, struggled and got the vote. And I think that, you know, that's a really important early part of the 20th century, universal suffrage. That is an incredibly important part of the highlight reel. The right to form a trade union, somewhat under threat and somewhat very difficult mm-hmm. now in lots of parts of the economy. Such an important part of the highlight reel. Limits on the working day. You know, it's like in the 1860s, I think it was, the average working week was 62 hours. Hmm. You know, now, yeah. you know, it's like we just cannot believe what, you know, the whole notion of the weekend was a sort of, is a relatively new concept. Now, lots of people work too hard today, but, you know, that came with struggle. We talked about it earlier, LGBT rights, you know, that is a really important part of, it seems to me, part of the highlight reel. You know, from the age of consent to equal marriage. The struggle against racism, which obviously is so much unwon, needs to be won. But the struggle for racial justice, I think that is part of the highlight reel. The Race Relations Act, other things that came in. Now, that isn't to say it's won, but it isn't. But so I think, you know, and in a sense, look, I think the thing I want to say is we get to write our own highlight reel. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to write the highlight reel of the future. And I think it is, I don't think it's impossible. I think it can feel very difficult, but I don't think it's impossible.
Do you think it's the nomenclature, the wording? Because I feel like in the same way that, like, feminism by its nature is socialist, it's egalitarian as an ideology. It's, you know, women should have the equal rights to pursue for any kind of pursuits they want. You know, your gender doesn't predispose what kind of life you should have, which I completely agree with. But some people have been able to subvert the term feminism and misrepresent it, and so it becomes conflated with misandry, or it becomes conflated with men hate or chauvinism. And I think maybe that's a problem with socialism as well, is that most decent human beings, irrespective of how they vote, think underprivileged children should be fed if they're not able to, you know, afford nutritional sustenance themselves. But when you broach these conversations with socialism, people begin to, their minds begin to move towards, you know, benefit scroungers and you know, benefit cheats.
They'll say Marxism. It's like a dirty word.
How have we been able to make this word, have such negative connotations? Is it that we need to move away from using words like socialism? Are they maybe somewhat archaic? And is there a new way we can contextualize the ideology that people can get on board with?
Well, and that's where Dane, before Ed answers, is just that's where you look at, you know, we love talking about the US here, and you look at you look at the people Trump mobilized, you know, who are being underserved in some respect. Well, they were not satisfied, clearly, you know, and therefore were pulled along by him. But, you know, these people would believe in socialist ideals if they were just told what they were. If they were told they were conservative ideals, you know, it's kind of, I think there's such confusion about what those words mean.
The banker bailout is a perfect example of socialism benefit
for the rich.
For the rich, benefit in private business.
Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting this, because there's this poll that recently came out from an organization called the Institute of Economic Affairs this week, actually, which is a relatively think tank on the right. And it said the poll of young people between the age of 16 and 34 found that 67% would like to live in a socialist economic system. They associate socialism with positive terms such as equal and fair. And, you know, I think there's something interesting about this. I'm not saying the labels are that helpful necessarily, but I think there is, people respond to circumstances, I think. And if you talk to people about not the labels or the sort of, you know, wonky terms, but the actual fabric of their lives and how they can be different and better, then I think people respond. I mean, just take this issue, because I care a lot about it, and it's actually, this goes in the highlight reel too, actually. Housing, right? Mm-hmm. I talk in the book about Vienna, the capital of Austria, and how they build lots of public housing. We haven't built public housing in this country for 40 years. And by the way, that's
almost two generations.
Yeah, on both parties, yeah. Right? Because Thatcher started it, and then the Labour government did some good things on housing, but it didn't build social housing at scale, right? I mean, and that would definitely be part of the highlight reel, by the way, because after 1945. Labour and Conservative governments, to be fair, built social housing, right? we're not going to solve our housing crisis. Governments of both parties have tried every which way they can to solve the housing crisis. People priced out, the private rented sector, homelessness, all that. We're not going to solve it unless we build our public housing at scale. I don't think that's socialist. I think it's just actually common sense.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. Yeah, that's a really good point of how we present certain things. In the same way that, like, if your nurses can't afford to feed themselves, they won't be able to take care of you when you get sick.
Exactly.
Do you know what? I know it's a slight tangent, but it's a branding exercise. You know, I work in television, Ed, you know, and sometimes I'm trying to come up with the right name for a show. I'm doing that with something at the moment. It's driving me up the wall. But, you know, I kind of look at it and go, okay, socialism, Marxism, left, like, we just need to, like, because, you know, the right, you know, as much as I wouldn't vote for a lot of what they do, they seem to package it in a way that, you know, obviously it plays on fear and it plays on kind of anxiety, you know, so it's not something I want to mimic. But you do wonder if there could be a nice little rebranding for the left. It could be international, Ed. You could be an international icon that rebrands the left.
I think I might have to leave the branding to you, Howard. I don't think I'm very good at the old branding. But there is something interesting about the right in Britain, and even about Trump, which is, you know, obviously I think Trump is appalling person. And I don't, you know, I'm not too keen on Boris Johnson either. They are having to mimic what were left causes and claim that they care about them. So if you think about Boris Johnson, he's saying, I care about levelling up inequality in the north of England. If you think about Trump, he said, I care about the fact that, you know, people don't have decent jobs anymore.
Yeah.
It tells you something about sort of where the zeitgeist is. People are asking questions about why is our society not working for us? Look, I have a constituency in Doncaster. I represent a constituency in Doncaster where most people voted for Brexit. Now, they didn't vote for Brexit, I don't believe, mainly because of immigration or the EU. They voted because they said, I want a new beginning. I want something better. I want an economic system that works for me. And in a way, you know, you've got to understand that and then think, well, how do we respond to that? How do we answer that? And I think there are answers. I think that's the... So I think, Howard, you're right about the branding. And I think the labels can be really off-putting for people. And I think, Dane, you're right to have a sense of realism about, you know, where we are, but I think it's partly about getting away from the labels actually and talking to people about their lives.
There's loads of baggage with those old labels.
I think the rigidity of how we label ourselves, particularly in social media where we have a lot of this political discourse, has made people feel they not only have to rigidly identify with these labels, but it means having an affinity with one label means you have to be diametrically opposed to the other, and that's not always the case. Some, like, being that it's a given a lot of time that, you know, being the descent of immigrants, that you would identify with a lot more socialist policies, obviously being a big part of representation of the staff of the NHS via Windrush. But by the same token, a lot of people in the Windrush or Caribbean community will have some conservative views, at least along, you know, Judeo-Christian lines in terms of belief. So there definitely has to be a ideology that, or political ideology that is, that has an intersectionality for everyone there, which, as you said, I believe is what we would historically call common sense. As I said, it makes sense that you want your medical professionals to be able to be fully nourished and be able to be of sound body and mind to perform their jobs better. It makes more sense for you to have police officers being supported and by their government so that they don't end up performing poorly because an underperforming police officer or an inefficient police officer manifests as police brutality and people responding to what they perceive to be an authoritarian state. It serves that if we are going to bail out bankers, then as far as I'm concerned, then that is a government being actually fiscally shrewd by being primary investors in an institution which will yield a dividend or return an investment. So if we're going to bail out the bankers, fine, but we are the primary shareholders. So if they're reporting profits now, then that profit, as preferential shareholders, should be returned to us as a dividend and reinvested into, municipal and civil services.
Yeah.
It's like because that's how the subprime mortgage happened in the first place. Local authorities and other aspects of government were investing in, you know, toxic assets like subprime mortgages in order to have a larger tax base or more coffers for, like, civil services. So why not take the money we've now invested into the banks that we now have profited from and reinvest that into the government. Like I said as a policy as well, that it would make sense if all municipal buildings, hospitals, fire stations, government buildings, town halls, etc., all had solar panels and all had a sustainable access
Definitely.
To renewable energy. And then you would be able to ratify to either, you know, and then you'd ratify the construction of said infrastructure to the working class and allow people to be involved in building their country and deriving their pride from being able to be directly involved in building their country as foremen or doing research and development into the most efficient energy usage. And if that works effectively, then by the same token, in a very Windrush way, that's a competency that Britain could import to the rest of the world in helping them develop a more sustainable or ecologically sustainable framework.
Common sense and evolution, eh?
Yeah, we solved the problem of lack of employment. We solved the problem of energy shortage. We can address the problem of climate change. And this is all done while still within the frameworks of a free market and providing new opportunities and not just and you know all the issues that a lot of people who are opposed to socialism.
Just on that last point, I think you're completely right about this climate thing because you know tackling the climate crisis is obviously an absolutely essential thing that we've got to do to avoid disaster. But in doing so, we can create a better world.
Yeah,
you know, warmer homes for people, more green space, better public transport, decent jobs. You know, I think it's actually the positive vision that is so important in this. I sometimes say, you know, Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. Yeah. And I think we've got to talk about the dream, not just the nightmare. I mean, that isn't saying we don't need to be truth-telling about the nightmare. We do. But we've also got to talk about the positive thing we can do.
Well, it's an interesting point because what we're discussing now in terms of like issues of like an ecological nature or juxtaposing ecological policy versus capitalism is... After Martin Luther King had a dream, his nightmare was the fact that he realized that he was trying to integrate his people into a world of where the real issue is economic disparity and that people's drive for financial or capitalist gain really is what drives the wedge between people along these lines of racial or sexual orientation. So that's why he's always like, I don't want to integrate my people into a burning house. Because if you use the analogy of burning, for example, Ed, like the smoke, the billowing smoke that comes from a blaze pollutes the air. And that's kind of where we are now, is that our burning of like fossil fuels and our burning of resources, our burning of even human beings as a resource and depleting into those resources is by creating division amongst people and, you know, leaving people to work harder than they ever done with remuneration as a result of that not being the same. Like, you know, how we've gone from those times. Like, what's crazy is that as much inequity that existed in Martin Luther King's time, even for your average white suburban family, you could probably survive off a sole income, which they can't do now. So, you know, even those who have benefited from ideas of white supremacy and racial inequity must realise now that we are dealing with a burning building and, you know, whoever has the matches, they don't really care about any of us. And so until we unite along some line of socialist or humanist policy, then... the world will literally burn, as we discussed. So
yeah, it's been. I mean, not. I don't know if that's the most positive moment to leave the episode.
I was going to say we've got to get to some optimism.
Well, yeah, the only way to avoid the nightmare is to wake up.
Yeah.
So if we all wake up and we all monitor all of our welfare, then we can return to a nice dream. But sometimes you need a nightmare to wake you up. A drink of water, wash your face. Check the person next to you is okay. And then in a big global platonic spooning session in the global that is the bed of our earth, then we can go back to the dream.
Well,
you heard it here first. spooning session.
That's the spin I'm going to put on it.
It's been a very lovely spooning session between the three of us. I know Dane will agree. This has been a real joy for us.
Absolutely. Even cooler than you sound on TV, Ed. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Really love the idea of the book and would love if you could tell our listeners where they could find out more about your good works and regarding the podcast and the book, etc.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. Well, look, Go Big, How to Fix Our World, which is my book, is now available at all good bookshops and online retailers too. I hope people will engage with it. Let me know what they think of it. Our podcast is Reasons to be Cheerful, which you can get on all podcast apps, and it's really and I think both of them are trying to say, look, we can create a better world and we shouldn't give up hope, and there are lots and lots of good people who are out there trying to create a better world, and anyone can be part of it, you know. You can't just leave it to the politicians. I feel that strongly as a politician. We can all do it. So I've been really enjoyed having being on, and really grateful for the invite, and really enjoyed this chat.
It's been our absolute pleasure.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at danebaptweets or Instagram at danesnaptiste.
Our guest was Ed Miliband. You can follow Ed on Twitter at ed_Miliband or on Instagram at ed_Miliband.
The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at thehowardcohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at @WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.